Part 7. Special Economic Issues. Chapter 24. Myths About Markets. Many a man has cherished for years as his hobby some vague shadow of an idea, too meaningless to be positively false. Charles Sanders Peirce. Perhaps the biggest myth about markets comes from the name itself. We tend to think of a market as a thing, when in fact it is people engaging in economic transactions among themselves on whatever terms their competition and mutual accommodations lead to. A market in this sense can be contrasted with central planning or government regulation. Too often, however, when a market is conceived of as a thing, it is regarded as an impersonal mechanism, when in fact it is as personal as the people in it. This misconception allows third parties to seek to take away the freedom of individuals to transact with one another on mutually agreeable terms, and to depict this restriction of their freedom as rescuing people from the dictates of the impersonal market, when in fact this would be subjecting them to the dictates of third parties. There are so many myths about markets that only a sample can be presented here. For example, it is common to hear that the same thing is being sold at very different prices by different sellers, apparently contradicting the economics of supply and demand. Usually such statements involve defining things as being the same, when in fact they are not. Other common misconceptions involve the role of brand names and of nonprofit organizations. While these are only a small sample of myths about prices and markets, looking at these myths closely may illustrate how easy it is to create a plausible-sounding notion and get it accepted by many otherwise intelligent people, who simply do not bother to scrutinize the logic or the evidence, or even to define the words they use. One of the reasons for the survival of economic myths is that many professional economists consider such beliefs to be too superficial or even downright silly to bother to refute them. But superficial and even silly beliefs have sometimes been so widespread as to become the basis for laws and policies with serious and even catastrophic consequences. Leaving myths unchallenged is risky, so scrutinizing silly notions can be a very serious matter. Prices. There seem to be almost as many myths about prices as there are prices. Most involve ignoring the role of supply and demand, but some involve confusing prices with costs. The role of prices. The very reasons for the existence of prices and the role they play in the economy have often been misunderstood. One of the oldest and most consequential of these myths is a notion summarized this way. Prices have been compared to tolls levied for private profit or to barriers which, again for private profit, keep the potential stream of commodities from the masses who need them. Crude as this notion might seem after examining the many economic activities coordinated by prices, it is an idea which has inspired political movements around the world, movements that have in some cases changed the history of whole nations. These movements, socialist, communist, and others, have been determined to end what they have seen as the gratuitous payment of profits that needlessly add to the prices of goods and correspondingly restrict the standard of living of the people. Implicit in this vision is the assumption that what entrepreneurs and investors receive as income from the production process exceeds the value of any contribution they may have made to that process. The plausibility of this belief and the conviction that it was true inspired people from many walks of life to dedicate their lives, sometimes risking or even sacrificing their lives, to the cause of ending exploitation. But their own political success in replacing price-coordinated economies with economies coordinated by collective political decisions took the issue beyond the realm of belief and into the realm of empirical evidence. During the course of the 20th century, that evidence increasingly made it painfully clear that eliminating price coordination and profits did not raise living standards, but tended to make them lower than in countries where prices remained the prevailing method of allocating resources. For decades and even generations, many nations clung to their original assumption and the policies based on it, despite economic setbacks that were often attributed to short-run growing pains of a new economic system or to isolated individual mistakes, rather than to problems inherent in collective decision-making by third parties. However, by the end of the 20th century, even socialist and communist countries began abandoning government-owned economic enterprises and all but a few diehard countries had begun allowing prices to function more freely in their economies. A very elementary lesson about prices had been learned at a very high cost to hundreds of millions of human beings. No one would say that wages were just arbitrary charges added to the prices of goods for the financial benefit of workers, since it is obvious that there would be no production without those workers, and that they would not contribute to production unless they were compensated. Yet it took a very long time for the same thing to be realized about those who manage economic enterprises or those whose investments pay for the structures and equipment used in such enterprises. Whether the payments received by those who contributed in these ways were unnecessarily large is a question answered by whether those same contributions are available from others at a lower cost. That question is one which those who are doing the paying have every incentive to have answered by hard facts before they pay out their own hard cash. Different prices for the same thing. Physically identical things are often sold for different prices, usually because of accompanying conditions that are quite different. Goods sold in attractively decorated stores with pleasant, polished, and sophisticated sales staffs, as well as easy return policies, are likely to cost more than physically identical products sold in a stark warehouse store with a no-refund policy. Christmas cards can usually be bought for much lower prices on December 26th than on December 24th, even though the cards are physically identical to what they were when they were in great demand before Christmas. A consumer magazine in Northern California compared the total cost of buying the identical set of food items of the same brands in various grocery stores in their area. These total costs ranged from $80 in the least expensive store to $125 in the most expensive. Indeed, they ranged from $98 to $103 at three different Safeway supermarkets. Part of the reason for the variations in price was the variation in the cost of real estate in different communities. The store with the lowest prices being located in less expensive Fremont, and the one with the highest prices being located in San Francisco, whose real estate prices have been among the highest of any major city in the country. The cost of the land on which the stores sat was different, and these costs had to be recovered from the prices charged to the store's customers. Another reason for price differences is the cost of inventory. The cheapest store had only 49% of the items on the shopping list in stock at a given time, while all three Safeway stores had more than three-quarters of the items in stock. Price differences reflected differences in the costs of maintaining a larger inventory, even when the particular commodities were physically the same. Customers' costs, measured in the time spent shopping, also varied. It varied both in the time that a customer would have to spend going from store to store to find all the items on a shopping list and in the time spent in checkout lines. One upscale supermarket was rated superior in the speed of its checkout line by 90% of its customers, but one of the low-price warehouse stores received a similar rating from only 12% of its customers. Consumers pay in both money and time, and those who value their time more highly are often willing to pay more money in order to save that time and the exasperation of waiting in long lines or having to go from store to store to buy all the items on their shopping lists. In short, people shopping at different supermarkets were paying different prices for different things, although superficially these might be called the same things, based solely on their physical characteristics. Reasonable or affordable prices. A long-standing staple of political rhetoric has been the attempt to keep the prices of housing, medical care, or other goods and services reasonable or affordable. But to say that prices should be reasonable or affordable is to say that economic realities have to adjust to our budget, or to what we are willing to pay, because we are not going to adjust to the realities. Yet the amount of resources required to manufacture and transport the things we want are wholly independent of what we are willing or able to pay. It is completely unreasonable to expect reasonable prices. Price controls can, of course, be imposed by government, but we have already seen in Chapter 3 what the consequences are. Subsidies can also be used to keep prices down, but that does not change the costs of producing goods and services in the slightest. It just means that part of those costs are paid in taxes. Often related to the notion of reasonable or affordable prices is the idea of keeping costs down by various government policies. But prices are not costs. Prices are what pay for costs. Where the costs are not covered by the prices that are legally allowed to be charged, the supply of the goods or services simply tends to decline in quantity or quality, whether these goods are apartments, medicines, or other things. The cost of medical care is not reduced in the slightest when the government imposes lower rates of pay for doctors or hospitals. There are still just as many resources required as before to build and equip a hospital or to train a medical student to become a doctor. Countries which impose lower prices on medical treatment have ended up with longer waiting lists to see doctors and less modern equipment in their hospitals. Refusing to pay all the costs is not the same as lowering the costs. It usually leads to a reduction of either the quantity or the quality of the goods and services provided, or both. Brand names. Brand names are often thought to be just ways of being able to charge a higher price for the same product by persuading people through advertising that there is a quality difference, when in fact there is no such difference. In other words, some people consider brand names to be useless from the standpoint of the consumer's interests. India's first Prime Minister, Jawaharlal Nehru, once asked, "Why do we need 19 brands of toothpaste?" In reality, brand names serve a number of purposes from the standpoint of the consumer. Brands are a way of economizing on scarce knowledge and of forcing producers to compete in quality as well as price. When you drive into a town you have never seen before and want to get some gasoline for your car or to eat a hamburger, you have no direct way of knowing what is in the gasoline that some stranger at the filling station is putting into your tank, or what is in the hamburger that another stranger is cooking for you to eat at a roadside stand that you have never seen before. But if the filling station sign says Chevron and the restaurant sign says McDonald's, then you don't worry about it. At worst, if something terrible happens, you can sue a multi-billion-dollar corporation. You know it, the corporation knows it, and the local dealer knows it. That is what reduces the likelihood that something terrible will happen. On the other hand, imagine if you pull into a no-name filling station in some little town, and the stranger there puts something into your tank that messes up your engine, or, worse yet, if you eat a no-name hamburger that sends you to the hospital with food poisoning. Your chances of suing the local business owner successfully, perhaps before a jury of his friends and neighbors, may be considerably less. Moreover, even if you should win, the chances of collecting enough money to compensate you for all the trouble you have been put through is more remote than if you were suing a big corporation. In an increasingly global economy, Europeans and Americans might be very hesitant to buy telecommunications equipment made halfway around the world in South Korea. But once the Samsung brand acquired a track record, people in Berlin or Chicago would just as soon buy Samsung products as buy competing products manufactured down the street. Asian companies in general have only in relatively recent history begun investing much time and money in making their brand names widely known, and still they spend less on this than other multinational companies. However, brand names like Toyota, Honda, and Nikon are recognized around the world, and the Cathay Pacific Airline and the Shangri-La hotel chain are also becoming better known internationally. Brand names are not guarantees, but they do reduce the range of uncertainty. If a hotel sign says Ritz-Carlton, chances are you will not have to worry about whether the bedsheets in your room were changed since the last person slept there. Even if you stop at a dingy and run-down little store in a strange town, you are not afraid to drink a soda they sell you if it is a bottle or can of Coca-Cola or 7-Up. Imagine, however, if the owner of this unsavory little place mixed you a soda at his own soda fountain. Would you have the same confidence in drinking it? Like everything else in the economy, brand names have both benefits and costs. A hotel with a Ritz-Carlton sign out front may charge you more for the same size and quality of room and accompanying service than you would pay in some comparable, locally run independent hotel, if you knew where to look. Someone who regularly stops in this town on business trips might well find a locally run hotel that is a better deal. But it is just as rational for you to look for a brand name when passing through for the first time as it is for the regular traveler to go back where he knows he can get the same things for less. Since brand names are a substitute for specific knowledge, how valuable they are depends on how much knowledge you already have about the particular product or service. Someone who is very knowledgeable about photography might be able to safely get a bargain on an off-brand camera or lens, or even a second-hand camera or lens. But someone whose knowledge of stereo equipment is far less than that same person's knowledge of photography might be well advised to purchase only well-known brands of new stereo equipment. Many critics of brand names argue that the main brands are all alike. Even when that is so, the brand names still perform a valuable function. The question is not whether Campbell's soup is better than some other brand of soup, but whether both are better than they would be if both were sold under anonymous or generic labels. If Campbell's soup were identified on the label only as tomato soup, clam chowder, or minestrone, with no brand name on the label, the pressures on all canned soup producers to maintain both safety and quality would be less. Brands have not always existed. They came into existence and then survived and spread for a reason. In 18th century England, for example, only a few luxury goods, such as Chippendale furniture, were known by their manufacturer's brand name. It was an innovation when Josiah Wedgwood put his name on chinaware that he sold, and which ultimately became world famous for its quality and appearance. In the United States, brand names began to flourish around the time of the Civil War. In 19th century America, most food processors did not put brand names on the food that they sold, a situation which allowed adulteration of food to flourish. When Henry Heinz entered this business and sold unadulterated processed food, he identified his products with his name, reaping the benefits of the reputation he established among consumers, which allowed his company to expand rapidly and an array of new processed foods bearing his name to be readily accepted by the public from the outset. In short, the rise of brands promoted better quality by allowing consumers to distinguish and choose, and by forcing producers to take responsibility for what they made, reaping rewards when it was good and losing customers when it was not. Quality standards for hamburgers, milkshakes, and French fries were all revolutionized in the 1950s and 1960s by McDonald's, whose methods and machinery were later copied by some of its leading competitors. But the whole industry's standards became higher than before because McDonald's spent millions of dollars researching the growing, storage, and processing of potatoes. Moreover, McDonald's established a policy of making unannounced visits to its potato suppliers, as it did to its suppliers of hamburger meat, in order to ensure that its quality specifications were being followed, and it forced dairies to supply a higher quality of milkshake mix. McDonald's competitors were, of course, forced to do similar things in order to remain in business. Afterwards, some might say in later years that leading hamburger chains were all alike, but they were all better because McDonald's could first reap the rewards of having its brand name identified in the public mind with higher quality products than they had previously been used to in hamburger stands. Even when the various brands of a product are made to the same formula by law, as with aspirin, quality control is promoted when each producer of each bottle of aspirin is identified than when the producer is anonymous. Moreover, the best-known brands have the most to lose if some impurity gets into the aspirin during production and causes anyone illness or death. This is especially important with foods and medicines. Like many other things, the importance of brand names can be seen more clearly by seeing what happens in their absence. In countries where there are no brand names, or where there is only one producer created or authorized by the government, the quality of the product or service tends to be lower. During the days of the Soviet Union, that country's only airline, Aeroflot, became notorious for bad service and rudeness to passengers. After the dissolution of the Soviet Union, a new privately financed airline began to have great success, in part because its passengers appreciated being treated like human beings for a change. The management of the new airline declared that its employment policy was that it would not hire anyone who had ever worked for Aeroflot. When it came to consumer products, Soviet consumers tried to make up for a lack of brands by developing their own methods of trying to figure out where a given product was made. As The Economist reported, in the old Soviet Union, where all products were supposed to be the same, consumers learned how to read barcodes as substitutes for brands in order to identify goods that came from reliable factories. In effect, Soviet consumers created brands de facto for their own benefit, where none existed, indicating that brands have value to consumers as well as producers. Among a business's assets, its money, machinery, real estate, inventory, and other tangible assets, its brand name may be its largest asset, though intangible. It has been estimated that the market value of the Coca-Cola Company exceeds the value of its tangible assets by more than $100 billion, and that $70 billion of that is due to the value of its brand. That is a very large incentive for them to maintain quality and safety in order to maintain the financial value of that asset. nonprofit organizations. We have seen that the role of profit-seeking businesses is better understood when they are recognized as profit and loss businesses, with all the pressures and incentives created by these dual potentialities, which force these enterprises to respond to feedback from those who use their goods or services, as well as feedback from those who invested the capital that made the business possible, and whose continuing investments are necessary for its continued existence and prosperity. By the same token, what are called nonprofit organizations can be better understood when they are seen as institutions which are insulated, to varying degrees, from a need to respond to feedback from those who use their goods and services, or those whose money enabled them to be founded and to continue operating. The tendency of those who run any organization, whether profit-seeking or nonprofit, military, religious, educational, or other, is to use the resources of the organization to benefit themselves in one way or another, even at the expense of the ostensible goals of the organization. How far this tendency can go can be limited by powerful outside interests on which the organization depends for its existence, such as investors, who will either get a satisfactory return on their investment or take their money elsewhere, and customers, who will either get a product or service that they want at a price they are willing to pay, or likewise take their money elsewhere. These outside interests are not as decisive in the case of nonprofit organizations. This does not mean that nonprofit organizations have unlimited money or that they do not need to worry about spending more than they take in. It does mean, however, that with whatever money they do have, nonprofit organizations are under very little pressure to achieve their institutional goals to the maximum extent possible with the resources at their disposal. Those who supply those resources include the general public, who cannot closely monitor what happens to their donations, and neither can those whose money provided the endowments which help finance nonprofit institutions. Much or sometimes most of those endowments were left by people who are now dead and so cannot monitor at all. Nonprofit organizations have additional sources of income, including fees from those who use their services, such as visitors to museums and audiences for symphony orchestras. These fees are, in fact, the main source of the more than $2 trillion in revenue received annually by nonprofit organizations in the United States. However, these fees do not cover the full costs of the goods and services being supplied. In other words, the recipients are receiving goods and services which cost more to produce than these recipients are paying, and some are receiving them free. Such subsidized beneficiaries cannot exert the same kind of influence or pressure on a nonprofit organization that can be exerted by the customers of a profit and loss business, since these latter customers are paying the full cost of everything they get, and will continue to do so only when they find what they receive to be worth what it costs them, compared to what they can get for the same money elsewhere. A nonprofit organization's goods or services may be worth what it costs the recipients, sometimes nothing, without being worth what it costs to produce. In other words, while an enterprise constrained by profit and loss considerations cannot continue to use resources which have a greater value in alternative uses elsewhere in the economy, a nonprofit organization can, since it need not recover the full costs of the resources it uses from the recipients of the goods and services it provides. Where nonprofit organizations are making grants of money, the recipients of that money are in no position to influence the way the nonprofit organization operates, as customers of profit-seeking organizations can and do. In the case of nonprofit organizations that serve as intermediaries in the transfer of human organs, such as livers and kidneys, donated to be transplanted to ill patients, these nonprofit organizations can impose arbitrary rules which neither doctors nor patients are in much position to challenge. In general, those who run nonprofit organizations are in a position vis-a-vis those who use their goods and services, very similar to that of a landlord during a shortage of housing. There is a surplus of applicants. Under these conditions, where neither the desires of the current users of the nonprofit organization's goods and services nor the original desires of those who supplied their endowments in the past have the kind of leverage that both customers and investors have on a profit-seeking enterprise, those individuals who happen to be in charge of a nonprofit institution at a given time can substitute their own goals for the institution's ostensible goals or the goals of their founders. It has been said, for example, that Henry Ford and John D. Rockefeller would turn over in their graves if they knew what kinds of things are being financed today by the foundations which bear their names. While that is ultimately unknowable, what is known is that Henry Ford II resigned from the board of the Ford Foundation in protest against what the foundation was doing with the money left by his grandfather. More generally, it is now widely recognized how difficult it is to establish a foundation to serve a given purpose and expect it to stick to that purpose after the money has been contributed, and especially after the original donors are dead. Much money can be dissipated in creating luxurious surroundings in the organization's workplace, or arranging showy conferences in posh hotels and resorts, held in upscale locations around the country or overseas. The aims of the organization can be bent to the aims of its current officials, or to decisions and activities that will gain them public visibility and applause, whether or not any of this serves the original purpose for which the nonprofit organization was founded, or even its current ostensible purpose. British writer Peter Hitchens observed that the government-established Church of England was more and more being run for the benefit of its own employees, rather than for the benefit of churchgoers or the country. Adam Smith made similar charges against endowed universities in the 18th century. Smith pointed out how academics running colleges and universities financed by endowments can run them in self-serving ways, being very indulgent to one another, so that each academic would consent that his neighbor may neglect his duty, provided he himself is allowed to neglect his own. Widespread complaints today that professors neglect teaching in favor of research, and sometimes neglect both in favor of leisure or other activities, suggest that the underlying principle has not changed much in more than 200 years. Tenure guaranteeing lifetime appointments is common in nonprofit colleges and universities, but is virtually unknown in businesses that must meet the competition of the marketplace, including profit-seeking educational institutions such as the University of Phoenix. Academic institutions, hospitals, and foundations are usually nonprofit organizations in the United States. However, nonprofit institutions cover a wide range of endeavors and can also engage in activities normally engaged in by profit-seeking enterprises, such as selling sun-kissed oranges or publishing the Smithsonian magazine. In whatever activities they engage, nonprofit organizations are not under the same pressures to get the most bang for the buck as are enterprises in which profit and loss determine their survival. This affects efficiency, not only in the narrow financial sense, but also in the broader sense of achieving the avowed purposes of institutions. Colleges and universities, for example, can become disseminators of particular ideological views that happen to be in vogue, political correctness, and restrictors of alternative views, even though the goals of education might be better served by exposing students to a wider range of contrasting and contending ideas. John Stuart Mill pointed this out in his essay On Liberty in 1859. He who knows only his own side of the case knows little of that, nor is it enough that he should hear the arguments of adversaries from his own teachers, presented as they state them and accompanied by what they offer as refutations. That is not the way to do justice to the arguments or bring them into real contact with his own mind. He must be able to hear them from persons who actually believe them, who defend them in earnest, and who do their very utmost for them. He must know them in their most plausible and persuasive form. Employment policies of nonprofit organizations have more latitude than those of enterprises which operate in the hope of profit and under the threat of losses. Before World War II, hospitals were among the most racially discriminatory of American employers, even though their avowed purposes would have been better served by hiring the best qualified doctors, even when those doctors happened to be black or Jewish. Nonprofit foundations were also among the most racially discriminatory institutions at that time. The same was true of the nonprofit academic world, where the first black professor did not receive tenure at a major university until 1948. Yet there were hundreds of black chemists working for profit-seeking chemical companies years before blacks were hired to teach chemistry at nonprofit colleges. Similarly, both black and Jewish doctors had flourishing private practices long before they could practice medicine in many nonprofit hospitals. Regardless of the purposes for which money has been donated to nonprofit organizations, it is spent at the discretion of people who can use it for their own perks, prejudices, or politics. The performances of nonprofit organizations shed light on the role of profit when it comes to efficiency. If those who conceive of profit as simply an unnecessary charge added on to the cost of production of goods and services are correct, then nonprofit organizations should be able to produce those goods and services at a lower cost and sell them at a lower price. Over the years, this should lead to nonprofit enterprises taking away the customers of profit-seeking enterprises and increasingly replacing them in the economy. Not only have nonprofit organizations not usually taken away the customers of profit-seeking enterprises, increasingly the direct opposite has happened. Nonprofit organizations have seen more and more of their own economic activities taken over by profit-seeking businesses. Colleges and universities are just one example. Over the years, more and more activities once run by nonprofit academic institutions themselves, college bookstores, dining halls, and other auxiliary services, have been increasingly turned over to profit-seeking businesses that can do the job cheaper or better, or both. As the Chronicle of Higher Education reported, Follett runs the Stanford Bookstore, Aramark prepares the meals at Yale University, and Barnes & Noble manages the Harvard Coop. The nation's most prestigious universities, and many others in academe, increasingly contract out portions of their campus operations. According to the Chronicle of Higher Education, money is the number one reason that colleges contract out an operation. In other words, commercial businesses not only run such services at lower costs, they make enough profit to pay the colleges more than these nonprofit organizations could make from the same operations on their own campuses. For example, the University of South Carolina rarely netted as much as $100,000 per year from its college bookstore, but Barnes & Noble paid them $500,000 a year to run the same bookstore. This implies that Barnes & Noble must have made even more money in order to pay the University of South Carolina more than the university ever made for itself from the same bookstore. Sometimes the reason many campus operations are more profitable under commercial business management is that profit-seeking enterprises reduce such waste as hiring year-round employees for highly seasonal businesses like college bookstores, where large sales of textbooks are concentrated at the beginning of each academic term. Other reasons include more experience at marketing. At the University of Georgia's bookstore, for example, 70% of the books were stored in inventory when the university ran its own bookstore, but after Follett took over, 70% of the books were put on display, where they were more likely to be bought. In the Middle East, the first kibbutz was founded in 1910 as a nonprofit community of individuals providing each other with goods and services and sharing their output on an egalitarian basis. That first kibbutz voted to stop being nonprofit and egalitarian in 2007, and by that time, so had 61% of the kibbutzim in Israel. One factor in that first kibbutz's decision to change was that young people tended to leave and go live in the market-oriented sector of the economy. In short, even people raised in the philosophy of a nonprofit institution like the kibbutz nevertheless voted with their feet to go join the market economy. Despite a tendency in the media to treat nonprofit institutions as disinterested sources of information, those nonprofit organizations which depend on continuing current donations from the public have incentives to be alarmists in order to scare more money out of their donors. For example, one nonprofit organization, which regularly issues dire warnings about health risks in the environment, has admitted to not having a single doctor or scientist on its staff. Other nonprofit organizations that are financially dependent on current contributions, as distinguished from large endowments, have similar incentives to alarm their respective constituencies over various social, political, or other issues, and few constraints to confine themselves to accurate or valid basis for those alarms. Chapter 25. Non-Economic Values. Beware the people who moralize about great issues. Moralizing is easier than facing hard facts. John Corey. While economics offers many insights and makes it easier to see through some popular notions that sound good but will not stand up under scrutiny, economics has also acquired the name the dismal science because it pours cold water on many otherwise attractive and exciting but fallacious notions about how the world can be arranged. One of the last refuges of someone whose pet project or pet theory has been exposed as economic nonsense is to say, economics is all very well, but there are also non-economic values to consider. Presumably, these are supposed to be higher and nobler concerns that soar above the level of crass materialism. Of course there are non-economic values. In fact, there are only non-economic values. Economics is not a value in and of itself. It is only a way of weighing one value against another. Economics does not say that you should make the most possible money. Many professors of economics could themselves make more money in private industry. Many people with a knowledge of firearms could probably make more money working as hitmen for organized crime, but economics does not urge you towards such choices. Adam Smith, the father of laissez-faire economics, gave away substantial sums of his own money to less fortunate people, though he did so with such discretion that this fact was discovered only after his death, when his personal records were examined. Henry Thornton, one of the leading monetary economists of the 19th century and a banker by trade, regularly gave away more than half his annual income before he got married and had a family to support, and he continued to give large donations to humanitarian causes afterwards, including the anti-slavery movement. The first public libraries in New York City were not established by the government, but by industrial entrepreneur Andrew Carnegie, who also established the foundation and the university that bear his name. John D. Rockefeller likewise established the foundation that bears his name, and the University of Chicago, as well as creating many other philanthropic enterprises. Halfway around the world, the Tata Institute in Mumbai was established by India's leading industrialist, J.R.D. Tata, as a scholarly enterprise, while another leading entrepreneurial family, the Birlas, established numerous religious and social institutions across India. The United States, which has come to epitomize capitalism in the eyes of many people around the world, is unique in having hundreds of colleges, hospitals, foundations, libraries, museums, and other institutions created by the donations of private individuals, many of these being people who earned money in the marketplace and then devoted much of it, sometimes most of it, to helping others. Forbes magazine in 2007 listed half a dozen Americans who had donated multiple billions of dollars each to philanthropy. The largest of these donations was $42 billion by Bill Gates, 42% of his total wealth. The largest percentage of his wealth donated by an American billionaire was 63% by Gordon Moore. For the American population as a whole, the amount of private charitable donations per person is several times what it is in Europe. The percentage of the country's output that is donated to philanthropic causes is more than three times that in Sweden, France, or Japan. The market as a mechanism for the allocation of scarce resources among alternative uses is one thing. What one chooses to do with the resulting wealth is another. What lofty talk about non-economic values often boils down to is that some people do not want their own particular values weighed against anything. If they are for saving Mono Lake or preserving some historic building, they do not want that weighed against the cost, which is to say, ultimately, against all the other things that might be done instead with the same resources. For such people, there is no point considering how many third-world children could be vaccinated against fatal diseases with the money that is spent saving Mono Lake or preserving a historic building. We should vaccinate those children and save Mono Lake and preserve the historic building, as well as doing innumerable other good things, according to this way of looking at the world. To people who think, or rather react, in this way, economics is at best a nuisance that obstructs them from doing what they have their hearts set on doing. At worst, economics is seen as a needlessly narrow, if not morally warped, way of looking at the world. Such condemnations of economics are due to the fundamental fact that economics is a study of the use of scarce resources which have alternative uses. We might all be happier in a world where there were no such constraints to force us into choices and trade-offs that we would rather not face, but that is not the world that human beings live in, or have ever lived in, during thousands of years of recorded history. Politics has sometimes been called the art of the possible, but that phrase applies far more accurately to economics. Politics allows people to vote for the impossible, which may be one reason why politicians are often more popular than economists, who keep reminding people that there is no free lunch, and that there are no solutions, but only trade-offs. In the real world that people live in, and are likely to live in for centuries to come, trade-offs are inescapable. Even if we refuse to make a choice, circumstances will make choices for us, as we run out of resources for many important things that we could have had if only we had taken the trouble to weigh alternatives. Saving lives. Perhaps the strongest arguments for non-economic values are those involving human lives. Many highly costly laws, policies, or devices designed to safeguard the public from lethal hazards are defended on grounds that, if it saves just one human life, it is worth whatever it costs. Powerful as the moral and emotional appeal of such pronouncements may be, they cannot withstand scrutiny in a world where scarce resources have alternative uses. One of those alternative uses is saving other human lives in other ways. Few things have saved as many lives as simply the growth of wealth. An earthquake powerful enough to kill a dozen people in California will kill hundreds of people in some less affluent country and thousands in a third world nation. Greater wealth enables California buildings, bridges, and other structures to be built to withstand far greater stresses than similar structures can withstand in poorer countries. Those injured in an earthquake in California can be rushed far more quickly to far more elaborately equipped hospitals with larger numbers of more highly trained medical personnel. This is just one of innumerable ways in which wealth saves lives. Natural disasters of all sorts occur in rich and poor countries alike. The United States leads the world in tornadoes, for example, but their consequences are very different. The Swiss reinsurance company reported that the biggest financial losses of natural disasters in 2013 were in Germany, the Czech Republic, and France. But that same year, the biggest costs of natural disasters in human lives were all in third world countries, the Philippines and India. Given the high cost of medical care and of such preventive measures against disease as water treatment plants and sewage disposal systems, third world countries likewise suffer far more from diseases, including diseases that have been virtually wiped out in affluent countries. The net result is shorter lifespans in poorer countries. There have been various calculations of how much of a rise in national income saves how many lives. Whatever the correct figure may be, X million dollars to save one life, anything that prevents national income from rising that much has, in effect, cost a life. If some particular safety law, policy, or device costs 5x million dollars, either directly or by its inhibiting effect on economic growth, then it can no longer be said to be worth it if it saves just one human life, because it does so at the cost of five other human lives. There is no escaping trade-offs, so long as resources are scarce and have alternative uses. More is involved than saving lives in alternative ways. There is also the question of how much life is being saved and at how much cost. Some might say that there is no limit on how much value should be placed on a human life. But, however noble such words may sound, in the real world, no one would favor spending half the annual output of a nation to keep one person alive 30 seconds longer, yet that would be the logical implication of a claim that a life is of infinite value. When we look beyond words to behavior, people do not behave as if they regard even their own lives as being of infinite value. For example, people take life-threatening jobs as test pilots or explosives experts when such jobs pay a high enough salary for them to feel compensated for the risk. They even risk their lives for purely recreational purposes, such as skydiving, whitewater rafting, or mountain climbing. Using various indicators of the value that people put on their own lives in various countries, a study at the Harvard Law School estimated that the average American puts a value of $7 million on his or her life, while Canadians put a value of $4 million each on their lives, and people in Japan put a value of nearly $10 million. Whatever the validity or accuracy of these particular numbers, the general results seem to indicate that people do not in fact behave as if their own lives are of infinite value, and presumably they value their own lives at least as much as they value the lives of other people. How much it costs to save one life varies with the method used. Vaccinating children against deadly diseases in third world countries costs very little per child and saves many lives, including decades of life per child. Meanwhile, a heart transplant on an 80-year-old man is enormously expensive and can yield only a limited amount of additional life, even if the transplant surgery is completely successful, since the life expectancy of an octogenarian is not very great in any case. If a life is not of infinite value, then it cannot be true that, if it saves just one life, some device, law, or policy is worth whatever it may cost. Certainly it cannot be true if the cost of saving one life is sacrificing other lives. Markets and values. Often the market is blamed for obstructing moral or social values. For example, writers for the San Francisco Chronicle referred to how amoral the marketplace can be when explaining why the water supply owned by the city of Stockton, California, could not be entrusted to private enterprise. Water is too life-sustaining a commodity to go into the marketplace with, the Chronicle quoted the mayor of Stockton as saying. Yet, every day, life-sustaining food is supplied through private enterprises. Moreover, most new life-saving medicines are developed in market economies, notably that of the United States, rather than in government-run economies. As for privately run water systems, they already exist in Argentina. The Economist magazine reported on the results of this privatization. Connections to the water and sewerage networks rose, especially among poorer households. Most richer households and families in the city center were already hooked up. Before privatization really got underway, in 1995, child mortality rates were falling at much the same pace in municipalities that eventually privatized and those that did not. After 1995, the fall accelerated in privatizing municipalities. The fall was concentrated in deaths from infectious and parasitic diseases, the sort most likely to be affected by water quality and availability. Deaths from other causes did not decline. In Britain as well, the privatized water supply in England has meant lower water bills, higher quality drinking water, less leakage, and a sewage disposal system that complies with environmental regulations a higher percentage of the time than that in Scotland, where the government runs the water system. This evidence may be suggestive rather than conclusive, but those who argue for political control of the water supply seldom see a need for any evidence at all. To many people, empirical consequences often matter less than deeply ingrained beliefs and attitudes. Whether in urgent or less urgent matters, many believe that those with political power are better qualified to make moral decisions than are the private parties directly concerned. Such attitudes are international. An entrepreneur in India reported his experience with a government minister there. I had argued that lowering the excise duty would lower consumer prices of shampoos, skin creams, and other toiletries, which in turn would raise their demand. The tax revenues would thus rise, although the tax rate might be lower. Indian women did not need lipsticks and face creams, felt the minister. I replied that all women wanted to look pretty. A face cream won't do anything for an ugly face. These are luxuries of the rich, he said. I protested that even a village girl used a paste of haldi so that she could look pretty. No, it's best to leave a face to nature, he said impatiently. Sir, I pleaded, how can you decide what she wants? After all, it is her hard-earned money. Yes, and I don't want her wasting it. Let her buy food. I don't want multinational companies getting rich selling face creams to poor Indians. The idea that third-party observers can impose morally better decisions often includes the idea that they can define what are luxuries of the rich, when it is precisely the progress of free market economies which has turned many luxuries of the rich into common amenities of people in general, including the poor. Within the 20th century alone, automobiles, telephones, refrigerators, television sets, air conditioners, and personal computers all went from being luxuries of the rich to being common items across the spectrum of Americans and among millions of people in many other market economies. The first video cassette recorders sold for $30,000 each before technological progress, trial and error experience, and economies of scale brought the price down within the budget of most Americans. In past centuries, even such things as oranges, sugar, and cocoa were luxuries of the rich in Europe. Not only do third-party definitions of what is a luxury of the rich fail to account for such changes, the stifling of free markets by third parties can enable such things to remain exclusive luxuries longer than they would otherwise. Markets and greed. Those who condemn greed may espouse non-economic values, but lofty talk about non-economic values too often amounts to very selfish attempts to have one's own values subsidized by others, obviously at the expense of those other people's values. A typical example of this appeared in a letter to the newspaper trade magazine, editor and publisher. This letter was written by a newspaper columnist who criticized the annual profit requirements faced by newspapers due to the demands of faceless Wall Street financial analysts who seem, from where I sit, insensitive to the vagaries of newspaper journalism. Despite the rhetorical device of describing some parties to a transaction in less than human terms, faceless Wall Street financial analysts, they are all people and they all have their own interests, which must be mutually reconciled in one way or another if those who supply the money that enables newspapers to operate are to be willing to continue to do so. Although people who work on Wall Street may control millions of dollars each, this is not all their own personal money by any means. Much of it comes from the savings or the money paid into pension funds by millions of other people, many of whom have very modest incomes. If the vagaries of newspaper journalism, however defined, make it difficult to earn as high a return on investments in newspapers or newspaper chains as might be earned elsewhere in the economy, why should workers whose pension funds will be needed to provide for their old age subsidize newspaper chains by accepting a lower rate of return on money invested in such corporations? Since many editors and columnists earn much more money than many of the people whose payments into pension funds supply newspapers with the money to operate, it would seem especially strange to expect people with lower incomes to be subsidizing people with higher incomes, teachers and mechanics, for example, subsidizing editors and reporters. Why should financial analysts, as the intermediaries handling pension funds and other investments from vast numbers of people, betray those people who have entrusted their savings to them by accepting less of a return from newspapers than what is available from other sectors of the economy? If good journalism, however defined, results in lower rates of return on the money invested in newspaper chains, whatever special costs of newspaper publishing are responsible for this can be borne by any of a number of people who benefit from newspapers. Readers can pay higher prices for papers. Columnists, editors, and reporters can accept lower salaries. Or advertisers can pay higher rates, for example. Why should the sacrifice be forced on mechanics, nurses, teachers, etc., around the country, whose personal savings and pension funds provide the money that newspaper chains acquire by selling corporate stocks and bonds? Why should other sectors of the economy that are willing to pay more for the use of these funds be deprived of such resources for the sake of one particular sector? The point here is not how to solve the financial problems of the newspaper industry. The point is to show how differently things look when considered from the standpoint of allocating scarce resources which have alternative uses. This fundamental economic reality is obscured by emotional rhetoric that ignores the interests and values of many people by summarizing them via unsympathetic intermediaries such as insensitive financial analysts, while competing interests are expressed in idealistic terms, such as journalistic quality. Financial analysts may be as sensitive to the people they are serving as others are to the very different constituencies they represent. Often what critics of the market want are special dispensations for particular individuals or groups, whether these are newspapers, ethnic groups, social classes, or others, without acknowledging that these dispensations will inevitably be at the expense of other individuals or groups who are either arbitrarily ignored or summarized in impersonal terms as the market. For example, a New York Times reporter writing about the problems of a middle-aged, low-income woman said, "If the factory had just let Caroline work day shifts, her problem would have disappeared." But, he lamented, "wages and hours are set by the marketplace, and you cannot expect magnanimity from the marketplace." Here again, the inescapable conflict between what one person wants and what another person wants is presented in words that recognizes only one side of this equation as human. Most people prefer working day shifts to working night shifts, but if Caroline were transferred to the day shift, someone else would have to be transferred to the night shift. As for magnanimity, what would that mean except forcing someone else to bear this woman's costs? What is magnanimous about someone who is paying no cost whatsoever, in this case the New York Times reporter, demanding that someone else be saddled with those costs? Both in the private sector and in the government sector, there are always values that some people think worthy enough that other people should have to pay for them, but not worthy enough that they should have to pay for them themselves. Nowhere is the weighing of some values against other values obscured more often by rhetoric than when discussing government policies. Taxing away what other people have earned in order to finance one's own moral adventures via social programs is often depicted as a humanitarian endeavor. But allowing others the same freedom and dignity as oneself, so that they can make their own choices with their earnings, is considered to be pandering to greed. Greed for power is no less dangerous than greed for money, and has historically shed far more blood in the process. Markets and morality. Whether assessing the effects of market economies or of government or other institutions, it is a challenge to make a clear distinction between results that emerge from those institutions and results caused by those institutions. Because a given institution or process conveys a certain outcome does not mean that it caused that outcome. As we have seen in Chapter 4, stores in low-income neighborhoods often charge higher prices than in other neighborhoods, but the causes of those higher prices are higher costs of doing business in those neighborhoods, not higher rates of profits resulting from arbitrary price increases by the stores. Many businesses and professions, in fact, avoid low-income neighborhoods because earnings prospects are usually not as good there. The same principle applies to many other institutions, whether in a market economy, a socialist economy, a government agency, or others. Some hospitals have higher death rates than others precisely because they have the finest doctors and the most advanced medical technology, and therefore treat patients with the most difficult, life-threatening medical problems that other hospitals are simply not equipped to handle. A hospital that treats mostly people with routine infections or broken arms may well have a lower death rate than a hospital that performs operations like brain surgery or heart transplants. Higher death rates at more advanced hospitals convey a reality that they did not cause. Similarly, everything that happens in a market economy or a socialist economy or in a government agency is not necessarily caused by those institutions. Everything depends on the particular facts of the particular situation. This affects not only questions about causation, but also moral questions. Income differences, for example, may be a result of barriers created against some groups, or a result of factors internal to the groups themselves, such as average age, years of education, and other factors that vary from one group to another. Most people, in the Western world at least, would probably consider arbitrary barriers against particular groups to be morally wrong and something that should be eliminated. But such a consensus is not equally likely if income differences are due to age differences, a factor that evens out over a lifetime, since all of us spend the same amount of time being 20 years old, 30 years old, or 40 years old, even if we are not all simultaneously at the same ages when statistics are collected. Nor is such a consensus likely if income differences are a result of differences in individuals' chosen behavior, such as dropping out of school or going on drugs, since many people feel no obligation to subsidize such behavior. In short, moral decisions depend on factual realities. However, people with different moral values can make different decisions about the same facts. Therefore, the policy question often comes down to whether some people feel that their moral values should be imposed on other people with different moral values through the power of government. Market economies permit individuals to make decisions for themselves, based on their own moral values or other personal considerations, and at the same time, the market forces them to pay the costs that their decisions create. The question is therefore not whether moral values should guide market economies, but whose moral values, if any, should be imposed on others or subsidized by others. Many whose sense of morality is offended by large economic disparities among individuals, groups, and nations tend to see the causes of these differences as advantages or privileges that some people have over others. But it is crucial to make a distinction between achievements and privileges. This is not simply a matter of semantics. Privileges come at the expense of others, but achievements add to the benefits of others. Few of us may have had whatever combination of factors enabled Thomas Edison to make electricity a major part of millions of people's lives. But vast numbers of people around the world benefited from Edison's achievements, both in his own time and in generations that followed. Whatever the sources of Edison's achievements, we have all benefited from those achievements, as we have benefited from the achievements of the Wright brothers and of others who added whole new dimensions to human life. Similarly, for the scientists whose work led to cures or preventatives for crippling diseases like polio or lethal diseases like malaria, even business leaders who simply found ways to produce goods and services better or to deliver them to consumers at lower cost contributed to rising standards of living around the world. All these things and more create economic disparities among individuals, groups, and nations with different achievements. That may seem morally offensive to some observers, but here again, moral decisions require an accurate understanding of facts and causes, as well as a clear distinction between privileges and achievements. Moral decisions and policies based on those decisions cannot be made on the simple basis of statistics, visions, and rhetoric, not if the purpose is to make human life better, either materially or otherwise, rather than to indulge one's emotions in disregard of the actual consequences for others. The moral judgment that life is not fair to individuals, groups, or nations, in the sense of providing them all with the same factors that promote economic prosperity or other benefits, is one that can be shared by people with very different moral or ideological values. As already noted in Chapter 23, neither geography, nor culture, nor history has presented equal opportunities to all individuals, groups, or nations, nor have such other factors as demography or politics. In the words of distinguished economic historian David S. Landis, nature, like life, is unfair. But not all sources of unfairness, in the sense of very different life chances, have moral dimensions. No one can be praised or blamed for the temperature of the air, or the volume and timing of rainfall, or the lay of the land. There are, of course, decisions and actions for which human beings can be judged morally or held responsible legally. But just looking at the bare facts of statistical disparities does not tell us which those are, much less what actions, taken now, can or will be effective. For that we need not only facts, but analysis, whether of economics, history, politics, or human nature. We also need to keep in mind a clear moral distinction between doing things that let us vent our pent-up feelings and doing things likely to actually help those who have been unfortunate in the circumstances into which they were born. Transferring income or wealth is relatively easy, but developing human capital among those who lag is far more effective, even if it is also far more difficult. After all, the income or wealth that is transferred has a limited time before it is gone, and continued economic progress depends on having the human capital to replenish this income and wealth as it is used up. Moral decisions cannot be divorced from the consequences they create. Morality is not a luxury, but a necessity, because no society can be held together solely by force. Even totalitarian dictatorships promote an ideology with their particular kind of morality, because not even a government apparatus with pervasive and ruthless powers of repression and terror is sufficient by itself to create or sustain a functioning society. But while moral principles are necessary for any society, they are seldom sufficient. To apply moral principles to an economy requires knowledge and understanding of that economy, and an ability to think things, not words, as Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes once said. Otherwise, attempts to help the poor, for example, may not merely fail, but be counterproductive if we cannot distinguish people who are genuinely and enduringly poor from people who are simply young and beginning their careers in entry-level jobs that they will soon outgrow as they acquire human capital that is valuable to themselves and to the society. Making blanket benefits available to the poor can short-circuit this process by making it unnecessary for many people to work, and minimum wage laws can make it harder for the young to find work, costing them both current pay and the acquisition of human capital for the future. Similarly, the need to think things, not words, makes the distinction between privilege and achievement not simply a matter of semantics, but an urgent need for clarity when making moral decisions. Privileges, which harm others, must be distinguished from achievements, which benefit others and advance society as a whole.